Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for the last week of June 2010. I'm reporter Elise Hugh, joined by CEO and Editor-in-Chief Evan Smith.
Hello.
Ben Philpott of the Tribune and KUT News.
Hello.
And reporter Reeve Hamilton is subbing in for a vacationing Ross.
Hello.
Today we are talking about speaker politics to the extent that has come back. Perry and White tied in a poll. An ethics complaint filed against Texans for Rick Perry, his political arm, and the latest race results in the Senate special election in Waco. Evan, we'll start with you and speaker race.
Well, I had the pleasure of speaking this week to Leo Berman, the state representative from Tyler, who we have no independent confirmation of this, but may have gone to high school with my father in Brooklyn. This is an interesting fact. So so Berman, I guess, talks to me because he,
he's like family.
I'm special.
Right.
and so I talked to Representative Berman both the night before he filed, when we heard it was going to happen. Sarah Acosta of our staff was able to break the story the night before Berman filed. And then after Berman filed, he talked to us. And you kind of understand what's going on here. You understand that this is really about the divide between the Republicans that we've been writing about in one form or another all year. You know, it was the divide at the center of the Hutchinson-Perry race. Reeve, when we get to the Birdwell-Sibley outcome in Waco, it's the divide at the center of that. It's the reason that Tommy Merritt and Delwyn Jones were returned to the private sector by Republican primary voters. There is a divide between conservative Republicans and what are perceived to be moderate Republicans, but really it's just
old
kind of
school Republicans,
old school establishment Republicans, and the forces on the farthest right wing of the party believe Joe Strauss is insufficient, insufficiently conservative, insufficient to the task of running the House, and so Berman is kind of the embodiment of that in his decision to challenge Strauss. It may be a fool's errand in that Strauss enjoys the support of most Republicans, many Republicans, a plurality, if not a majority. He will be the candidate of the Democrats because the Democrats, unless they take back over the House unexpectedly by a great margin, will not be able to elect one of their own as Speaker.
And they're not going to push further right. They're not going to support a further right.
No. And the fact is, from their
vantage point. You heard it here first.
Yeah, right. From their vantage point, Joe Strauss is a Democrat. I mean, of course, Tracy Young is right now dialing my cell phone number furiously to challenge that. But the reality is that from the Democrats' perspective, Strauss may as well be a Democrat in that they view him as fair. They can work with him. They see him as more moderate rather than less moderate. Now, Strauss says proudly and I think convincingly, I'm a conservative. But there are people to his right who say, no, you're not.
And well, I think it's because he wasn't willing to throw bombs on the floor of the House in the last session.
Berman cited a couple things to Julian Aguilar of our staff when he talked to him on Tuesday morning. He said he wouldn't bring voter ID to the floor. He wouldn't bring pro-life legislation to the
Berman
floor.
Berman said that.
Berman said Strauss. This about Strauss. And Berman said that Strauss was also not willing to bring immigration, hardline immigration legislation to the floor. Well, this may be like the divide between the platform at the Republican convention and the elected officials who go, yeah, the platform's nice, but over here we live in the real world.
Right.
The platform is an articulation of ideals and principles, but at the end of the day, they can't work. And what Berman is asking Strauss to do may be practically impossible.
And I think that's a great parallel, actually. And we should mention, though, there are plenty of Formocratic supporters who have stayed with Strauss all the way through, have continued to get good chairmanships, Vicky Truitt.
Well, Jody Laubenberg is an example that is often held up as someone who you would think ideologically would be with the non-Strauss folks, but in fact is a Strauss supporter.
Right, and right. He's been able to maintain support from a lot of those folks. So
Jody Laubenberg and I have the same birthday, by the way.
Just Hitler's birthday.
And also Hitler, the three of us. See if you can triangulate that. Also Jessica Lange and Crispin Glover. Reeve.
Reeve, is that
what
your
was
birthday
I
too?
About?
I honestly, I don't know who I share a birthday with. But one thing I thought
was turning into first reading. Go ahead.
One thing I thought was interesting that maybe shows.
Jason, we love you. No, we don't. Yes, we do. Go ahead.
No.
Maybe shows a difference. I'm totally lost now.
But anyway, see, Ross goes away, and this is what happens. You were talking about Berman and Strauss.
Oh, well, one argument that Berman brought up that shows an interesting divide between Strauss and the speaker that went before him was this thing about voter ID and how Strauss refused to take control during voter ID and instead gave the gavel to the speaker pro tem, Democrat Craig Island.
Craig Island, right.
And Strauss said, well, we were on the local and consent calendar. That's just House tradition, which shows, you know, that's him playing by what he, you know, playing by the rules, fair, but maybe to the Democrats' advantage.
Look, there's resentment of Strauss because Strauss chose to treat the Democrats with respect.
As humans.
Right? I mean, he gave the Democrats a certain number of chairmanships, whether it was proportional to the percentage of Democrats in the House or not. He gave the Democrats chairmanships. His whole mission in taking over the speakership was, let's return the House to its natural, stable, respectful, kind of procedure-focused center, as opposed to making it, you know, cobble, you know, a war zone. We're going to turn it into something a little bit more stable. And, he, you know, for better or worse, he's done it. From Berman's perspective, worse. Now, of course, the question on everyone's minds at the Capitol is Berman a stalking horse for somebody else?
Right. There's a lot of talk. We should explain that to folks who may not be as tuned in. There's a lot of talk that Phil King is actually the brains behind all of this, and that he has very publicly and privately opposed Strauss by coming up with this other action committee, right, where they're raising money and all of this.
And not to turn this the stalking horse conversation into, like, you know, the horse farm of stalking horses, but in fact, Phil King, it is often speculated, is himself a stalking horse for
Craddock.
Tom Craddock. Now Craddock is dialing my cell phone, having said that, to complain about that. But the reality is, if you breadcrumb this thing back, there's probably more than just Berman behind this, and, you know, it remains to be seen whether there are enough people. I mean, this is the point. Are there enough people sufficiently dissatisfied with Strauss that they can get the number of votes they would need? You have to assume that no Democrat's going to support Berman unless a Democrat has a super perverse sense of humor. Right?
You could support Berman to be ironic.
I mean, I think there are probably Craddock D's. I'm not sure there are Berman D's, right? You know, Harold Dutton is not going to suddenly go, I'm with Berman, right? So what happens then?
Harold Dutton, who I share a birthday with.
Is that
while
so?
While
we're on the subject, for reasons I can't remember, I did this. I realized that. But the point here is simply that there are not going to be Berman D's, and so if there are not going to be, and they're not going to be Phil King D's, so if there are not going to be those guys, then you take the number of Democrats who are left standing after November out of the equation, and then it's simply a math problem for the non-Strauss guys, and I don't see how that math works.
Strauss basically just needs. I mean, he wants to have a majority of Republicans, but he needs, what, 15 Republicans to essentially get reelected?
But, of course, this is the Berman argument. The Berman argument is he's not a Republican speaker. He's the speaker who is elected by the Democrats plus 15 or something like that.
Democrats and rhinos.
Right. And you know, he referred to them as Joe Strauss's henchmen, which is sort of a good name for a band at South by Southwest, actually, too. Joe Strauss's henchmen. But the point here is I don't know that the numbers are there on that side of the equation. And so the Berman thing may ultimately be more of a manifestation of anger, as much of the Tea Party stuff this year has been, more than a practical,
right?
Let's work toward this outcome.
I agree. Let's move to our second topic, which is Ben Perry White, 43 question mark.
Yeah, you know,
maybe a short conversation.
Well, I'm not a fan of polls anyway. I just tend to think that, especially in kind of our polarized society where it's a bunch of people just yelling at each other on the TVs and radios and newspapers, that it's hard to really get a grasp of what people are thinking, because you just, depends on what TV station they were watching before they got the phone call and was asked, who do you think you'll vote for? But one of the things that, this is the public policy polling out of North Carolina. One of the things that I thought was interesting in this poll that shows them tied is that they mentioned that Rick Perry was losing Hispanics and libertarians. Number one, libertarians. A libertarian Republican is going to vote for either a libertarian or a Republican, and probably not Bill White. But the other one is, there's always been the talk of what will the Hispanic vote do once the Hispanic vote materializes in Texas. Yeah. And I don't think that there are, it's almost like, okay, sure, Bill White can win the election with the Hispanic vote, but it has to show up. It's not that Perry will lose enough Hispanic vote and it will shift over to Bill White. There isn't enough Hispanic vote in the Perry camp, even if all of it disappeared and went to Bill White, to make Bill White the winner. So I just think that that's kind of a flawed
statement. Except that this, at least going back to Tony Sanchez's campaign, you know, the white whale out there that everyone is after is, how do you energize both the eligible non-registered and the registered non-voting Hispanics of Texas? The assumption, probably exaggerated but mostly true, is that they would help the Democrats more than the Republicans,
right?
Significantly.
And at least on a first go around.
I remember Tony Sanchez in the map room behind Tony Sanchez's office in his company in Laredo, where he had these floor-to-ceiling maps showing the different counties of Texas where there were all these unregistered or non-voting Hispanics. And he said, basically, if we just get these guys, there's no way that Rick Perry can beat me. Well, Rick Perry, of course, is still the governor. And beat him pretty handily. And, you know, look, the white campaign is correct to be optimistic about the Hispanic vote, but as you say, it's got to turn out.
Yeah. It's not about drifting away from Perry. It's about showing up in the first place.
Reeve, did you look more into kind of these pollsters and what might be skewed in this poll? Because, you know, there's a lot of talk that Rasmussen skews Republican.
Well, people generally associate public policy polling with the Democrats because their clients tend to be Democrats.
Right. Okay.
People tend to say Rasmussen is conservative. Public policy polling has a pretty respectable rating on 538 and the Wall Street Journal.
Of course, Nate Silver has now got his knickers in a knot over whether his own question about his own accuracy are being brought up now, right?
Yeah, but he also just struck a deal with the New York Times. They've always had their, you know.
Right, but I guess the point is that, you know, all these every pollster is right until he's wrong, and every pollster is wrong until he's right. I mean, I don't know whether public policy polling is more accurate on a percentage basis.
And every poll, you know, polls are good until you disagree with them.
Right. Right. If the public policy polling poll had showed Perry up by 12, the same people who were attacking that poll as not credible would be going, greatest thing in the world.
Right.
Lifting it in a chair like at a bar mitzvah, you know.
Right.
But the fact is, you don't believe that poll is accurate, do you?
No, but I do like the fact that it came out post chicken suit, and it gives us hope that we might have that.
The chicken suit turning point.
Which we talked about last week.
Conversation.
So now Mark Strama will be dressed as a pig at the next Perry rally. We're going to test various animals to see if they work to drive the poll.
I hope, true or not, it inspires more barnyard outfits on either side.
You're pro. Among the things we like about Reeve is he's pro barnyard. That's good. Look, I'll say it. I don't believe the poll.
Right.
I don't believe the poll.
Do you think the poll is crap?
Well, Ben,
something's got to be.
I think that probably the race is not tied, and that probably the race is not mid double digits. That probably the race is sort of 7-8.
But yeah,
well, they say it's a 4-point margin of error. So if you add 4 to Perry, take away 4 from White, there's that 8 points.
Yeah. You know, it's within the margin of error of the Rasmussen poll that shows an 8-point difference, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and that's, it's also probably as much about party breakdown in the state. And you know, look, the White campaign has a right to be touting this poll, because if it had gone the other way, the Perry campaign would be touting
it.
And they have a right probably to be optimistic, because all good news is good news. But at the end of the day, the only poll that's going to matter, we always say this, not theirs and not ours even, is going to be on Election Day. And if, as you point out, Ben, that's when we're going to know whether the opportunity they have with the Hispanics ultimately materializes.
Right. And I think the poll coming out this week is interesting, because it seems to be coming out in a two-week period where maybe for the first time the Bill White campaign can say, you know what, we've had a good 2 weeks against Governor Perry. There was the chicken suit. You know, I mean, at the very least, it knocked the Perry people off message and allowed Bill White to kind of lead the talking points. And then this week there's been, you know, talk of part-time Perry kind of leading the conversation. And yesterday, I believe it was yesterday or Tuesday, depending on when you're listening to this podcast.
Are you segging to my topic, Ben?
I don't know. There was the email that came out.
He has no idea
what
the topic is.
Evil.
You know, he can't remember stuff when you don't screw with him. Why would you make it worse?
This is not. So okay. It was the email came out on Tuesday saying the Perry campaign put out an email saying, look how hard Governor Perry is working to bring economic development to Texas. And that kind of falls, you know, he was on an economic development trip. The email could have come out anyway. But I just think, you know, Bill White's had a good week of part-time Perry, and all of a sudden you see the Perry campaign say, look how hard he's working, which is just, to me, that's the first time in this race where you've had Perry responding to what Bill White has said.
Let me second that. We have been very quick on this podcast to diss the White campaign for not being sufficiently aggressive in attacking Perry and questioning whether they had allowed a lot of grass to grow while Mark Minor attacked Mayor White for not releasing his taxes. The White campaign is doing, I would say, significantly better on communications in the last couple of weeks.
And on top of all those dings.
I think the part-time Perry thing is the first, conceptually, the first attack on Perry that has lasted more than one news cycle, that has stuck. And of course, the basis for this, people remember, is that the governor's schedules came out and it showed that he basically worked like 7 hours a week, right, was what the what the deal was. And, you know, White, in fact, I thought you were going to refer to a different email, which was that I got an email yesterday because I'm on both campaigns' email lists, and the one I got was from Bill White. The subject line was 7 hours.
Yep.
And you open it up, and it was a solicitation from White to the people who give money to candidates saying, he worked 7 hours, I'm going to work full time, the problems of Texas are too big for a part-time governor. Well, you know, you can kind of understand the whole concept of a part-time. I mean, that's like
this could be a strong meme.
That's actually an interesting meme, and I think that they've done a good job of sticking to that. And just as the antecedent to Bill White is always liberal trial lawyer in the Perry campaign, the White campaign has started to just do part-time Perry. And you know what? That's the kind of thing that now I wonder what if they had started out this way. Right. If you go back to March, if they had come roaring out of the gate as opposed to limping out of the gate, would it have been different?
I wonder why the Hutchison team hadn't jumped on this.
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons why the Hutchison. I mean, let's not get into that.
Okay. Anyway, let's move forward. This kind of relates to my topic because on top of all those dings, Texans for Public Justice, a watchdog group, has filed an ethics complaint against Texans for Rick Perry, his political arm, for
a progressive or liberal watchdog group. To
yes,
be fair, right?
Yes.
We acknowledge that.
And they filed an ethics complaint with the Texas Ethics Commission, essentially saying that the Perry campaign hasn't been forthright in itemizing their expenditures. So they use political donations in order to pay for various expenditures at the mansion. Dating back to 2001, it's about $800,000 in spending. And instead of saying, you know, we spent money on the clothes hanger or we spent money on, you know, food or servers or bartenders, it just says in their Ethics Commission filings, mansion fund.
Is this permitted?
The state law or ethics law requires that you stipulate how you spend your political expenditures. So if I'm to charge a bunch of stuff on my credit card for my office or from or for my political purposes, I'm having a party and I go to Party City and I go to, you know, World Market. All those things need to be itemized. World Market, wine, you know, Party City, balloons, instead of Visa.
Everyone loved balloons.
MasterCard. And so Donna Dukes had a problem with this. She was
right. You, in fact, broke a story when you were a reporter previous organization before you came into the rushed into the arms of the Tribune.
I didn't know there was such a time.
No. you actually busted Donna Dukes's chops.
And she ended up getting a huge fine from the Ethics Commission because she didn't itemize, and she kept saying she was going to go back. To this day, they haven't gone back to find all the receipts on that. So this could be a problem with the Ethics Commission. Of course, they move glacially slow, so this won't come out before the election. But again, politically, it's just another ding. It's not.
And the Perry people are dismissing it essentially as, you know,
all they actually,
socialist communist watchdog group attacking us on behalf of the White campaign.
They haven't said much at all, actually. We've asked Mark Minor or another spokesperson to go on camera to respond, and they've instead just said our statement speaks for itself.
And what is the statement?
And the statement is we've done everything in compliance with what other governors have done. And there's no other statement. So that's all we've heard.
Within compliance of what other governors of Texas have done?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's
when was the last time we had another governor of Texas?
Yeah, seriously.
Who remembers?
Ba-dum-bum. Ching. Right. All right, so let's move on to our final topic, which is all the intrigue in Central Texas in Waco. Brian Birdwell beats David Sibley in the special election.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
I guess the podcast is over, Reeve. You can go back to playing World of Warcraft.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, basically, yeah. Brian Birdwell sort of surprised everyone and went against conventional wisdom by beating David Sibley, who was backed by George W. Bush, among other prominent Republicans.
Jim Pitts.
The entire lobby in Austin.
Sibley was a made guy.
Sibley is a, you know, big name around the Capitol. It sounds like it probably hurt him that since he's a former state senator, since he retired, he's been a lobbyist. As a lobbyist, you're going to donate to others.
You spread your money around.
Yeah, which includes Democrats, which Birdwell has not donated to Democrats. Birdwell has a compelling story. He was in the Pentagon during 9/11 and was badly burned and survived. He's more Tea Party affiliated. So, I mean, it was a big win for in my story, I call them the no-compromise wing of the
anti-establishment.
Yeah, anti-establishment. Sort of anti-incumbent because Kip Averitt, who is the outgoing state senator, was backing Sibley and was hoping that Sibley would be his replacement. And that got very complicated because at this moment, Kip Averitt is still the nominee for the next term because he dropped out of his reelection bid, but not before he could take his name off the ballot and easily won his primary because he's a popular guy there. So he's still the nominee. He's not challenged. Before the election, he questioned whether or not Birdwell was eligible to have that seat because there's some questions about whether or not he's lived in the district.
There's a five-year residency requirement to run, and Birdwell voted in a Virginia election in November of 2006. And if you do the math, if he was a legal resident of Virginia in November of 2006 and voted in an election there, then he has not been a legal resident of the district for 5 years.
Right, and I just talked to him, and he said, well, he was there serving his country. He was there in the Army, and he was on medical leave for his, well, not medical leave, but he was there for medical reasons relating to the Pentagon attack. And his residence was actually in Texas, and he had bought a house in Texas. He bought his house in the district 5 years ago. But he didn't move there until afterwards.
He bought his house in the district 5 years ago.
Right.
Is that where he claims his homestead exemption? Because does that help you establish residency?
I guess, but I mean, if you legally vote somewhere, I mean, that's saying my residency is here because you can't go back and forth.
I want to say I don't know every single thing about, and we're actually here at the Tribune investigating currently the kind of various corners of the residency requirement law. But logically, either Texas is screwing up or Virginia screwed up. Now, did you vote in the presidential election in Tennessee, Reeve, when you were going to Vanderbilt?
I voted in the Senate election in 2006.
Tennessee. Okay. So,
and I voted in Tennessee in 2008 when I was living in New York.
My head's now spinning. But the question is, did any of that necessarily invalidate that you are a Texan and therefore could claim residency in Texas?
That's the big question, I don't know. Yeah.
I didn't own a house here.
College. I can tell looking at you right now, you don't own anything. But my point is that if you're a college student and you vote in the community in which you go to college, it may not be your home state. Does that shift your residency? You're a resident then. In other words, can Birdwell claim that he basically bookmarked his Texas residency for the period of time in which he was convalescing in Virginia and voted there because he was allowed to, but he never actually forfeited his residency back in the district?
Yeah, I mean, I never had to get a Tennessee driver's license or anything to, you know, be able to vote in Tennessee.
When I was working in other states, I still voted in Texas.
I just think it's an but the point of all this was that as you said that Averitt was concerned enough about whether Birdwell's eligibility would be challenged,
right,
that he was considering staying on the ballot just so that the Democrats did not snatch the seat away.
Right, and because if he withdraws his name, when he withdraws his name, because he says he's going to the next couple of days,
right.
Theoretically, the party chairs in the district will put Birdwell as his replacement because that's the people's choice, and but the Democrats, who never put someone up in the primaries, will have a chance to put a Democrat up, and there'll be just another campaign in Waco.
Well, and let's just talk about that for a second if we have time, because this is actually very interesting. So initially, when Averitt got out, the question was raised, why have the Democrats not filed against Averitt? Wasn't it stupid of them not to file? And it was pointed out to a number of us that by putting a Democrat up for that seat, only to lose. The Republicans would have a greater turnout-the-vote mechanism by way of that Senate seat, which would ultimately hurt Chet Edwards, who is going to be in a close race for his congressional seat. So if the Republicans had a contested Senate seat, turnout would be higher. Edwards would ultimately lose, ultimately lose votes because more Republicans would come out to vote for whoever was running for the state Senate and would ultimately vote for Bill Flores in the congressional seat. So the Democrats were talking about basically not running anybody. Interestingly enough, they would have had a hard time beating Sibley. They would have had a hard time beating Averett. They might have chosen not to run anybody against those two. I actually wonder whether they're going to run somebody against they could beat Birdwell in theory easier than they could beat Sibley or Averett because Birdwell is much further to the right of either Sibley or Averett.
Are we sure that Averett isn't going to keep his name on the ballot?
He told Reeve this morning he was pulling out. Yeah. So it's going to be Birdwell. So the Democrats are going to have to decide what to do. There's already been speculation that John Mabry, who is a
former state lawmaker,
might run. Heck, Jim Dunham could run. I mean, there are a number of Democrats in Waco who are brands. You know, Lyndon Olson, the former ambassador to Sweden under Bill Clinton, who is a big macher, as my grandmother would say, in Waco. Not that my grandmother would ever have been to Waco, frankly. I mean, you might actually get like a big brand to run. Birdwell can't be beaten, but
I mean, well, we'll probably get a chance to see.
And the question is, do the Democrats still have that Chet Edwards concern?
Now that my mind is thoroughly blown.
I got nothing.
Ben, do you want a last word? Okay. All right, let's wrap this up. If you have any questions or comments for the Tribcast, you can email us at podcasts@texastribune.org. We'll be here next week. And on behalf of Evan, Ben, and Reeve, I'm Elise. Thank you for listening.